Welcome to the latest edition of the IDEA podcast from the Irish Development Education Association. I'm your host, Eimear Green, and today's episode focuses on the emergence of development education in Ireland. We have two speakers, Dr. Eilish Gillen, who is head of the Department of International Development at Maynooth University, and Adrian Boyle, community activist, development and development education worker, and former director of IDEA. The moderator for this session is Elaine Mahan, who is the Capacity Development Manager with IDEA. I hope you enjoy.
Okay, so you're very welcome to the emergence of development education in Ireland today. We're very pleased to be joined by Dr. Eilish Dillon and also by Adrian Boyle. So Eilish is the head of department at the Department of International Development in Maynooth University, and she's been involved in development education in a wide variety of contexts for over 30 years and has also completed doctoral research on discourses of DE in Ireland in 27. And it was an article then that appeared in the Centre for Global Education's Policy and Practice that kind of inspired today's event, because Eilish gave a really good overview of the development of the sector in that, and I learned a lot reading it, and I thought this would be great knowledge to have out in the sector, or to fill in maybe gaps for some of us, but also to record it as an institutional kind of memory for IDEA and for the entire network, and for us to record today and maybe develop it into a video or a podcast. So that's Eilish. And then we're also really happy that Adrian has joined us. So Adrian Boyle, very first director of the IDEA, Irish Development Education Association. And Adrian describes herself as a sailor forced ashore and who wanted to connect the local to the global. But she's a community worker by background and someone who is very committed to and energised by global justice and injustice. I'm going to hand over now to Eilish. Yep, off we go.
Great. Hi, everyone. It's really nice to be here. And thanks very much, Elaine and Adrian, Elaine, for organising the session. And it's really nice. I wasn't one bit nervous before this until I saw all the people who are here. And I'm thinking about all of what everybody knows and everybody having such different experiences of of development education, global citizenship education over the past number of years. So I hope that really that you'll all see the kind of introduction that I'm going to do as my story on all of this. It's one version of it all. And I'm going to try and intersperse some of what I've written about, which draws, of course, on the work of other people, with some of my own experiences. And I hope that that then will spark some kind of, I suppose, memories and connections for many of you. So I'm not in any way setting this up, by the way, as the definitive kind of history or anything like that. It's very much one kind of a take on it. So what I'm calling it today is History Matters. And I suppose because I think history matters a lot, I think it's really important history that we understand where we've come from. But also history matters talking about, I suppose, what are the things of the past. Why I'm really interested in history and the history of development and education in particular, or global citizenship education. And I'm going to call it development education today, just for want of a term, and I won't go into terms if that's all right. Why I'm interested in it really is because I think it helps us to understand the present. So what is it? How have we got to where we are today? That is, I suppose, crucial, I feel, for understanding both the positives and the challenges of where we're at with development education today, but also for shaping the future. So I have had a long-standing interest in trying to make sense of that story for myself. And of course, we could do it in lots of different ways and in lots of different versions. I'm particularly taken by that 100 Objects of Global Solidarity that exhibition or event that developmenteducation.ie have up on their website. And I'd really encourage any of you to have a look at it, because it kind of shows us really that the things that were our day to day in development education are now of the past, but they can also be and tell us of the future. So archiving is really important. And that's one thing, I suppose, that I have changed over the 30 odd years that I've been involved. I used to emphasize the kind of the doing and action side of development education. And now I also feel that it's really important to chart, to archive, to tell stories, and to write about all of this. So that's what I've been trying to do over the last few years. So for me, a critical history, and I call it critical because I think that's about being critically reflexive of our past and our present. For me, it should help us to look under the surface and to use Audrey Brown's phrase, to turn the gaze back on ourselves, so that we actually ask the critical questions of what it is we think we're doing, why we're doing it, and what what its effects are, and to ask questions about the taken for granted. And that's why I did some research, as most of you or many of you know, on different approaches to development education within the Irish education sector over the last number of years. And to challenge, kind of, or be able to challenge mainstream thinking, not to take things for granted, and sometimes to be uncomfortable. And some of our past is not that comfortable, and it's not always what we would aspire to in the present. So all of that for me really is about shaping the future that we need. I would say shaping an alternative present and shaping the future. So it's with that in mind, I suppose, that I present this kind of three-pronged kind of starting point for where are we at today? And I think those three things are very important to remember about development education in Ireland today. It's not always the same old, and we are different. And people are different, and there are different approaches to development education in Ireland today. Even where led by idea, there's a kind of a striving towards consensus. It's my view that there's a lot of diversity. While there's a lot of consensus in the way we talk about things, that's not always reflected in practice, I think. And I think many of us would agree with that. So that can be because of, you know, an emphasis on different adjectival educations, or because of the specific history of the organization within which we work, or because of a different kind of focus. So some are much more kind of driven, if you like, by curriculum issues. Others are much more driven by an activist kind of campaigning style type focus. I think it's really important to understand that. Well, it is for me anyway, because that makes history helps us to make sense of why that's the case. It also, I feel, helps us to make sense of why we don't sometimes question each other in a more questioning or critical way. Because we live very comfortably sometimes in the land of a sense that we're all in it together. And that's really helpful, but it sometimes can be constraining, I suppose. So that's the first point. The second point, I think, is that over a 50 or 60 year period, there is no question but development or global citizenship education has become more central, both in terms of development cooperation policy and also in education. When I was thinking about this over the last few days, thinking about the role of TROCRA and the role of the Curriculum Development Unit in kind of centralizing development and global citizenship education in the formal education sector, whether it's at primary level, second level, over the years, that has been really central. So even though many of us would strive for that to be far more integrated across lifelong learning, and we were involved in the kind of, I suppose, discussions around the strategic, the development of an Irish Aid strategic plan, there's no question but that has become more centralised. But there have been, dips and troughs in all of that in terms of the role of CSPE in the 1990s and the early 2000s, global politics and society coming in after that, then the kind of the role of initial teacher education in the last number of years. I'll talk about some of that stuff as we go on. So it has become increasingly central, but on the other hand, it's often on the back page. And one person mentioned that to me when I was doing the research back in 2016. Did you ever notice that DevEd is always the last thing in the strategic, in the kind of the government strategic plans or annual reports? It's always on the back page. So that's a really interesting thing. There's also, of course, that debate about whether it should be more promoted by the Department of Education or Foreign Affairs and Trade. And that debate has been there for the history of DevEd in Ireland, largely. So that's two kind of key points I want to say as starting points from my point of view or my understanding of it. It has been very much driven by a development focus, whatever that is. So it's funded within development cooperation. It started off very much as the language of development education, and that still is very central in an Irish context, even though that's shifting, as we know. And of course, that has implications then, because it's very hard then to shift away from a north-south kind of global focus, the assumption being that the problems are in the global south and that together we can solve those problems, rather than shifting the focus to a kind of a global focus where we see development challenges as being global, often much more located in the so-called global north, but actually they're global and they're everywhere. So that's one of the impacts of development education being driven by the development sector. Another, of course, is that kind of emphasis on participatory learning and process-based learning, which is for many people a very positive thing. I think a third one, without going into it, is that there's a tendency, in my understanding, within the development education sector, not to critique or criticize development cooperation. It's kind of like, we'll take that for granted as a good, we leave that over there and we won't ask any questions about it. And this assumption, limited enough debate or critical debate about aid and its value. Lots of people talk about other stuff. And of course, as we know, Stephen McCluskey and others in Policy and Practice, that really important journal in our sector, Stephen often talks about another thing that people don't talk about is neoliberalism and the global capitalist economy. So the fact that it's driven by development, I feel, has positives, but it also has potentially constraining negative influences, including, of course, the kind of contradictions that arise from and within NGOs about the kinds of communication practices that are still being used, which are still very stereotyped, albeit maybe not the hard stereotypes of the kind of the flies in the eyes kind of representations by most organizations, but there are still a lot of stereotyped kinds of images being used. And the challenge and the tension of all of that for many of us who are really critical of all that. So that's the starting point. Key characters, if you're not there, my apologies, everybody who's here and the organizations that you represent are characters in this story of the history of development education in Ireland. I think Irish Aid has played a very significant role in it all. But as you can see, the NGOs and missionary organizations, the networks, they're also there, as are kind of global links and networks. So we could be here literally until next week if we were to go through the history of each of those organizations. But as I mentioned to Elaine in our discussions around all of this, I think I really would love to work to develop some of this history into much more detailed kind of work in the future to tell the stories of all of these organizations. Sheila Dillon did a really lovely piece on the history of Trocar's DevEd. That's available on the Trocar website, and they also have a kind of history of their development. Robin Hannan did a history of Kolov back in the day. I don't know if that's available online now. And there was a history of DOCUS done as well. I think Hans Zummer did that. So some people, there are little pieces. And of course, the main work was done by Matthias Fielder, Audrey Bryan and Melissa Bracken did a super history of the kind of role of Irish Aid in development education back in 2011. So it's about bringing all of those stories together and new ones, creating new ones. So I thought I'd ask you before, in the spirit of DevEd, rather than just blasting ahead, before I just talk about three phases in the development, which of course is problematic and limited, before I do that, I just thought I'd ask you to reflect for a moment, if you wouldn't mind, on who introduced you to this whole area in the first place, and how long ago was it? And then maybe to think about what changes you've seen in development education, human rights education, anti-racism education, global citizenship education since then. Like if you were to point to something, I just picked those two sets of images there. There are two changes that I've seen. I've seen the move from the Millennium Development Goals to the Sustainable Development Goals. And those are three Irish aid development strategies that have been developed in the time that I've been involved. I was at the consultation, as many of you were, some of you, Barbara, you probably were very much more involved in the development of those strategic plans right throughout the 2003 one, etc., up to date. So where did all this come alive for you in the first place? And of course, that's a valid and really important thing to realize, that this is all, I suppose, to enact this in our lives. So as part of my exploration today, I want to look at these three phases, the informal beginnings from the 1970s and 80s, and some people will go back further, to the formalization of development education in the 90s and up to the mid 2000s. And from the crash, I suppose, the financial crash in 2008 up to now, what I call fallout and new professionalism. And I'm going to look at actors involved, different strands of thinking, and how some of those have become more prevalent. And I thought I might talk a little bit about what that looked like in my life of being involved in development or global citizenship education, because I thought that might spark you all to think about your own experience, not really because I think mine is any greater or anything, any great shakes, but I do think about it from our own perspective is useful, though limited, of course. So just taking that first kind of in the 1970s and the 1980s, where did all of this come out of? And why I think about the different strands is it came out of different places. So, of course, in other countries in Europe, and Doug Byrne has written some really interesting historical pieces on the development of development education around Europe, etc. Basically, in Ireland, DevEd was very much led by the NGOs and by missionaries. And CONCERN, as we know, was established in 1968 after the war in Biafra and the humanitarian work that CONCERN was doing. And CONCERN at the start, of course, wouldn't have been engaged in education, but it did get involved in education in the 1970s and 80s, particularly through the CONCERN debates. TROCRA, as we know, when it was established in 1973, it had a dual mandate to do work overseas, but also in Ireland, very much looking at the kind of the role of education in bringing about some kind of an understanding of responsibility around justice. And from a state point of view, when we joined the EEC back in 1973, there was a commitment. We had to sign up to a commitment to give some of our budget to development cooperation overseas. I did most of a doctorate that I never finished on APSO and the formation of APSO. And what's really interesting for me is that because of the missionary tradition, there was an emphasis in Ireland on the person-to-person form of development. And so when development cooperation was established in Ireland back in in 1974, I think, the bilateral aid program was established, a lot of the emphasis was on person-to-person sharing and on skills share. So I feel that has actually had an impact on how we kind of think about in Ireland, and we think about activism often as an individualized kind of a thing. But anyway, we also emphasise, of course, there's quite a bit of emphasis on volunteering and support for that and immersion schemes and all that kind of thing over the years. So back in the 1970s, we can see that there was a start. And it wasn't just what became the bigger NGOs. There was also Congood was established as the network out of which DOCUS emerged in 1977. And in 1975, COLOV was established as a group of return development workers who wanted to get together to understand why there was global injustice in the world and to create awareness about all of this. So that's another kind of an emphasis on development education. And the Chemish Development Studies Centre was established as well, with a focus on kind of education and training for those who were engaged in development in the Global South. So there was this start of a sector, the beginnings of a sector, if you like. And then funding for development education was instigated in 1978. There was a big speech by, I think it was Michael Kennedy, I can't remember his first name, minister in the Dáil, about the need for people in Ireland to learn about global inequality and injustice. And that's way back in 1978. And that was at the start of funding for it. And DESC was established in 1985, which was basically the first kind of, if you like, the first state unit for promoting and supporting development education. And some of you might be able to fill in the gaps on that I have here as I'm running through all of this, and even correct me if I'm wrong on some of the stuff. So what I'm trying to get at is, even back in the 1970s, there were different strands. So you had this values-based inspired development education, which was influenced by liberation theology in Latin America, kind of, you know, questioning injustice, North-South kind of equality concerns. And I would say that that was very much linked to kind of a Trokerist approach, which also was influenced by Paulo Freire, solidarity approach, and Kolov would have been influenced by that, or, you know, would reflect that. There was a more development as charity approach as well. And many NGOs, when they started off, you know, engaging with schools, they just wanted to tell them about what are the problems, this is what we do, and fundraise for us. But then, of course, that changed over time. And so it moved away from all of that. So I was in primary school in the 1970s. And what I remember, I was in a presentation, primary school in Kilkenny, and what I remember was we'd all be brought to the assembly hall, and the nuns who were over in the Philippines or in Zimbabwe, and I later went and spent a summer in Zimbabwe with the Presentation Sisters back in 1991. But anyway, they would come in and they would tell us about the work they were doing, about how brilliant the kids were, that they really wanted, they were good in school, you know, they were really enthusiastic learners, unlike us, Shower. And they basically told us all about this exotic world. So much so that myself and my sister, when we were, you know, 9 or 7 or 9 or 10 or whatever, we wanted to become missionary nuns. And that was my influence, and I'm sure many others. But then when I went to secondary school, one of my teachers who wasn't a nun and who seemed pretty, you know, like, anyway, she taught me history, as it happens. She had worked in Nigeria as a teacher. And I thought, God, OK, maybe I could do that. So this whole thing about the 1970s, it wasn't necessarily about, it wasn't that we had development education very evidently in our curriculum, but there were traces of it all over the school. I remember when the Troker boxes came out, I remember the anti-apartheid movement throughout the 70s and then later in the 80s, of course. And when I went to college, I learned about Paulo Freire and had a very strong sense of the role of Trokra and its allocation of 20% it had to development education at the time. So Trokra would still feel that development education in all of this area is central to their work. So moving on then into the 1990s, from an actor's point of view on the different strands, this was very much about the time of when development education became much more formalized and institutionalized. And when I say institutionalized, what I mean by that really is that institutions and structures were established. So there was very much emphasis on curriculum development. And again, I point to the role of Trokra in supporting and working with Aidan and the Curriculum Development Unit, City of Dublin VEC, in trying to develop kind of the influence of development education across the curriculum in CSPE and transition year, etc., and working with the NCCA and the different trade unions around all of this. Okay, so that was very much kind of, I suppose, the sense was that if you could get development education into the schools, you're really on a winner. But we do know that while it is hugely significant, and it's kind of nearly in some ways the most logical and the easiest way to develop a kind of a spread of development education. On the other hand, schools aren't always the most kind of radical spaces. So sometimes then, you know, what starts off as something that's quite potentially very radical can get diluted a little bit. But anyway, there's lots of research on all of that. At the same time as you had all of that, lots of NGOs, including many of the organisations that you are representative of, engaged in visiting schools. And I didn't go into this, but the development of resources has always been a thing. So whether it's about water or it's about hunger or it's about debt or whatever. And I remember myself as a teacher, I was a teacher in a secondary school in the 1990s, using a lot of those resources that were developed. And it's very interesting to look back at some of those resources. I haven't been able to do so for today because they're all in my office in Maynooth, but a lot of them are in my office in Maynooth. But they're very critical and radical, and it's very useful to kind of look back at those resources, many of them available on developmenteducation.ie. So schools, NGOs went into schools. The concern debates were huge in the 1990s. They were for me, it was a key thing that I was involved in as a teacher in school. And it was an opportunity for me to engage with young people about these issues. So there was a lot of work going on in schools. There was also the influence of the EU NGO Liaison Committee. So I think it's really important as a person involved in the sector in Ireland to remember that it's not just that even back in the day, it wasn't just an Irish sector. There was always connections and networks across Europe, which were hugely influential. So if something was happening in, you know, the UK or in France or wherever it was happening, you know, this had an influence. And also, of course, in the 1990s, lots of organizations were hooked into EU funding for development education. I think it was DG8 at the time, and I was involved in Coloff in Cork, and we were involved in some development education grant projects. And I see Gertrude there. So Gertrude and I would have been involved in some of that work together back in the 1990s. And Coloff in Dublin had two big EU-funded projects on development education, bringing it all back home. That's BIABH, which was about kind of engaging with return development workers in order to kind of raise awareness within the country about development issues and, you know, activism and all that. And NODE, which was the Network Outreach on Development Education Project, I was involved in that and the steering committee of that at the time. And what that was trying to support kind of regional or locally based One World centres or development education organisations and groups. And the Centre for Global Education in Belfast was one of those, Galway One World Centre, Waterford. There were little centres or groups of people around the country who were very much engaged in development education, and that was trying to support them. Now, like all things, none of these projects are perfect or anything, but it does show that there was a growing level of activism at a whole range of levels. So you had the curriculum stuff happening in formal education. DEFI, through the National Youth Council, had One World Weeks, which were huge in terms of kind of engagement with young youth organizations and youth clubs. And then there was kind of, I suppose, offshoots of various organizations, including Benulacht, which was established as a feminist development education organization out of the women's group within Coloff. So lots of different things happening across different kinds of sectors. And part of the reason for this, or that it was able to happen, was because of the funding to development education from Irish Aid, with the National Development Education Grants Committee established in 1990 and the National Committee for Development Education in 1993. Now, they sound like big owl acronyms, but basically what that was funding that was put aside from within the development cooperation budget and administered by DESC at one stage and then the NCDE, etc., to support small organisations, small groups, schools even at one point, to engage in development education. So this was hugely, hugely significant. I'll come back to where the strategic plan came out of in 2003, but there was a lot of emphasis on development education, human rights education, etc., throughout the 1990s. So on the one hand, we have key actors and events, and then the strands. In the 1990s and the mid-2000s, there was a growth of what they call the adjectival educations, human rights education, education for sustainable development, and intercultural education and anti-racism. The development of each of those three is so interesting to me, even in itself. Human rights education, reflective of, I suppose, the growth of Amnesty in this area, but more so the Convention on the Rights of the Child in 1990, and an emphasis that Trokra put on education in the 1990s on human rights. And that then permeated into the work that the curriculum development unit was doing as well. So there was a big emphasis on human rights and rights-based approaches to development, etc., in the 1990s. Some of that stuff is really worth looking back at in this era when we need critical frameworks. Some of it is really worth looking at. Education for sustainable development in the 1990s. If you think about global movement around environmental concerns, think to the 1987 Brundtland Report, the Rio Conference in 1992, 500 years after the so-called discovery of the Americas by Columbus, and the whole critique of the time of the silencing of indigenous rights. So that kind of question about the right to development, the importance of taking account of the environment and questioning growth, that all had a big emphasis, a big influence on the growth of education for sustainable development. And Eco-UNESCO was one of the key drivers of all of that in an Irish context. And then in terms of intercultural education and anti-racism, we had a change in Irish society in the 1990s, changing population and following, I suppose, from the UK as well, the importance of integration and in its most inclusive and diverse a fashion, and intercultural education and anti-racism comes out of that, and an anti-racism strategy at the time. So there are millions of different influences. And then the growing focus on citizenship post the the Balkan, crisis, and post the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989-90, the emphasis on citizenship in Europe and education for citizenship became very much, it became much stronger in Europe. So, as I mentioned earlier on, CSP was introduced in 1997. And I think into the mid-2000s, we've had huge influence from thinkers like Vanessa Andreotti and her critique of soft versus critical development education, and moving us towards decolonization, which I would say is the language of the now. So this emphasis on mainstreaming, on building strategic partnerships, that was hugely important, really influential on the sector. So I'm not going to go into all that. Some of what I wrote on this stuff is just for you guys, for everybody afterwards, if you want to have a look at it. But just the strategic plan, the Irish Aid strategic plan from 2003 in bold over on the right. I'm always struck by this as an aim or a goal, that every person in Ireland will have access to educational opportunities to be aware of and understand their rights and responsibilities as global citizens and their potential to affect change for a more just and equal world. I think it was really aspirational, really powerful a sense. It should be for everybody. It's not just a an extra add-on. This is for everybody. And there was a very influential research done in 2002 by Michael Kenny, who works in Maynooth, and Siobhan O'Malley, I think, who did some research on the sector at the time in 2002. They were asked to do so, and it basically influenced the establishment of the first Irish Aid, it was DCI at the time, strategic plan on DevEd in 2003. And also the establishment of IDEA in 2004. In the 1990s, just some stuff that was going on, I wanted to show you some pictures of some of the stuff that was going on for me. I was very involved, as I mentioned, in Kolov, and Kolov obviously produced Focus on Ireland and the Wider World. At some point, there was a magazine called Cork in the Wider World. We were involved in some kinds of campaigning. The Code of Conduct on Images and Messages, that was around since 1989. The EU NGO Liaison Committee around Europe, all the NGOs agreed on this kind of code of conduct around ethical messaging way back then. And as many of you know, I'm doing some work on that at the moment. In 1992, I was lucky enough to go to Central America for the summer, and I was one of the people who were on a brigade. I suppose what I'm trying to show here is that there's this range of different approaches and influences on development education was very much evident in the early 1990s and part of my own experience. And then later into the 2000s, from my point of view, I suppose my experience shifted. I moved first of all from Cork to Dublin and started to work in Amnesty, as I mentioned earlier on, and with the Kimmage Development Studies Centre for many years. And I was very active in Bunulacht. And then we had the start of IDEA in 2004. So when I reflect back on my own experience, I can kind of write this history in some ways through that. And then just kind of bringing us up to date, in recent times, I suppose, after the 2008 financial crash, there was a significant loss of funding. What there was there were cuts in funding to development cooperation, and development education was cut disproportionately, arguably. Now, some of that has come back. But I guess what I feel has happened in those years is you could call it that development education has become more strategically organized. There have been much more strategic partnerships developed. And that's very effective. It has the effect of being effective and organizing things very well. And of course, at that time, since 2008, the emphasis on results and performance management and new managerialism has become huge. This kind of accountability to funders, obviously, to the taxpayer, really important. But also a kind of while all of that is really important, it can become then quite technical, quite heavy on bureaucracy. And when I was doing my research, lots of people talked about being completely overburdened by the bureaucracy of accountability. Nobody actually was anti-accountability, but everybody said that it serves, not everybody, but most people said it serves to depoliticize, or it directs attention away from where people often want to be. So what that has actually led to in practice is lots of the smaller organizations either decided not to apply for Irish Aid funding, or they weren't given Irish Aid funding and they've kind of gone by the wayside. So that's a feature. So the feature, the sector has become stronger in some ways and more consolidated, but also some of the kind of radical edges, and some of those edges were never radical, but some of the edges are gone, if you like. There's some people are very critical of the big NGOs. But actually, when you look at the funding, and I won't talk about funding now, but if you look at the funding, the big NGOs in particular, Concern and Trocra, have consistently given, you know, put, you know, fairly big budgets towards development education, global citizenship education, and their public engagement. But I suppose sometimes then, if again, I go back to that question about to what extent it's driven by a kind of a north-south kind of perspective. So to what extent does it integrate kind of issues in that global sense? And I think organizations are trying to do that. The emphasis has become in formal education very much on initial teacher education, Worldwise Global Schools, Ubuntu Network, DICE, etc. Huge advances there. no question. And most recently on the kind of code of good practice for development education. And I think we've moved from development education to a kind of a global citizenship framing for all of this work. And that's really positive in the sense that it embraces the activism side of things and the global. It's about translating that into practice. For me now, we are very much involved at the university, at the Department of International Development, in trying to integrate this a development education approach to our work, but also to develop programs around development education. I suppose what I think it all helps us to understand is the sector is diverse. It has been heavily influenced by actors. We could, you know, do a whole history of key people and who has have made a difference. And I have a load of key people in my head who I think helped to shape the way things are in terms of development education in Ireland, going back to the 80s, the 90s, right into the 2000s. There has been definitely growing professionalism, and it's held up as a role model, but it's often not as critical as we think it is. And our talk is often very aspirational, but sometimes we're afraid to address some key debates and questions. So there are still a lot of elephants in the room, I suggest, that, you know, the sector would, yeah, it would be really good if we had a lot more critical debate about what it is that we are doing in the name of development or global citizenship education. So anyway, I hope that you found some stuff in there to, stimulate some thought or whatever it is. Anyway, I hope you found it helpful. Thanks a million, Elaine. Thanks, everyone.
So thanks so much, Eilish. I mean, you mentioned to me, you know, we could write a book on this with lots of contributions from different people and different chapters. I think that's a great idea because you can see how much information there is and you really just skimmed the surface. But you did it in a lot of depth at the same time. So I'm sure there was a lot more you could say. So we'll hand over to Adrian now. Adrian, are you ready to go?
Yeah, I'm ready to rock and roll. That was just fascinating to hear all of that as well, because so I became involved really in IDEA in 2005 and stayed involved 2005, not so much 2006, but then 2007, 2008. And basically I'm a community worker, but I do a lot of independent work in both the normal community sector, the local community sector, and then in the global sector. So I tendered for a strategic planning process with IDEA in 2005. As another piece of work, really. And I found myself open to this amazing world of development education that I wasn't really as aware of, though I had been involved in Bunulok. I was involved in Bunulok, and I was involved as a return development worker from Palestine in with Kolov and a lot of the work on refugees and Palestine that Kolov did at that time. So I came into the strategic planning process, and IDEA, Elaine and Eilish said, was the launch was in 2004. And some of the things that I found were the actual old launch, the actual launch brochure and report of that 2004 launch. Basically, after the launch, they got a lot of money from IrishAid just to do a strategic plan. So I had this something like 10,000 euros to do a strategic plan, which is a massive amount for a strategic plan. So it gave me the opportunity to really go around the country and see what was going on. So we had workshops in Cork, in Galway, in Belfast, and two in Dublin. We asked for submissions across all the sectors. And then we did a whole pile of kind of individual interviews, but it gave me a lot of time to kind of do all that. And then eventually kind of put that together in a strategic plan that went to the 2005, end of 2005 AGM and was finalized there. But basically what I found at that stage in 2005, which is, you know, 15, 16 years ago, I found this vibrant, energetic groups of people everywhere doing development education in the higher education sector, the youth sector, in the community sector, across the board. But an awful lot of people came to those meetings, to those workshops, and the energy that was there was really, really, really fascinating. And in all, there were about 40 organisations across the board of that state just involved in that strategic kind of planning process. So that was great. So that was just the original leaflet for the actual launch in Wynn's Hotel in 2004. In 2004 for the launch of the. Of IDEA itself. So this again was just again the strategic budget 2006 to 2008, and it's interesting that's the very first one, and the second one that we did was by Annette Honan actually. She did it towards the end of my time with IDEA in 2008, and she did it for 2009 to 2011. It's very interesting the different strategies that were the same strategy, but the priorities kind of changed in the 2009-2011 period. This is really what came up in terms of the concerns for the sector at this point in time. And you can see people really concerned about the invisibility of IDEA, the invisibility of the sector. And you must remember, IDEA didn't exist then. There was no office, there was no structure, there was no website, there was no leaflet, there was no logo, it wasn't a company limited by guarantee, it wasn't a charity, it wasn't It was a really strong, like Eilish said, a really strong and very active kind of group of people who were beavering away. And even I found a work. I wasn't involved in 2006. I did this in 2005, and then I left it, and they went off beavering away to get funding for the next stage. But I found a work plan for 2006, and it clearly was very active in terms of the National Council at that stage and the working groups at that stage. But this was 2005. So they really wanted a real vision, a named vision for IDEA, for this embryonic organisation as it was at the time. They wanted to get a better understanding of how it contributed to our society. They really wanted it to grow, and they wanted it to grow as a kind of a structured kind of grouping. They wanted to have recognition by the public and the decision makers, which is why it's very interesting to hear what Eilish said in terms of how the funding, I wasn't as aware of that in terms of the Irish Aid, how the funding started so long back and then was developed. Then they wanted it to be what came out of that process was the credibility of the organization, because almost till then, one of the things that I got a real sense of, that it was kind of regarded as a bit hippie, you know, a bit out of an old era of, you know, kind of a hippie type. It was alternative, that's what I mean. It was alternative, creative and alternative, but it really wasn't credible in terms of a structured, serious sector that contributed towards development. So the credibility and visibility were really critical things. It did want it to have impact on all levels of society, and it wanted to be a strong and vibrant, and you could see it was already a strong and vibrant sector, but it just didn't have the organisation around it that that was needed at that stage. So what really came out of the strategic plan, which is really interesting, was the whole thing was the really absolute priority focus was developing IDEA as an organisation. And as I said, it didn't exist except for a really good, strong group of voluntary people. And these were people who were very engaged at that time and know a lot more about that previous time than I did. So developing it as an organisation, a structured, visible, credible organisation, was actually critical. Building capacity within the sector was a second priority. Promoting good practice, which is just really interesting seeing that, and then seeing our great award recently this week of the Code of Good Practice that Elaine in her good work and IDEA and its good work have successfully brought it to massively developed it. And representing and advocacy on behalf of the sector, that was interesting, that was always number four at that stage, whereas that slowly has moved up the agenda. And interestingly enough, the second strategic plan that Annette Honan from the NCCA did in her independent role, it had moved down that building the capacity of the sector was one, promoting good practice was two, developing ideas and organisation was three, and representing an advocacy remained in its place like the Eurovision Song Contest at number four. So that was interesting. And I was just reading very recently, just the because it came through in the the emails just yesterday, I think, or the day before, was the new, just the annual report, and how the priorities have, again, in terms of strategic focus, how what a long way we have come. We've done some of those things. We have developed, IDEA has developed as an organisation. The sector has massively built its capacity, and we can see that good practice, although it's still work to do, that we've got lots of good structures, around it. Now, interesting, at that stage, again, these were this was 2005, remember 2006, these were the challenges that people saw as important for the future. And it's interesting, again, to look at them now and see how many of them have been solved. So the long-term funding, continued confidence in the sector, visibility and professionalism of the organisation, that's IDEA, visible outcomes for members, strong ownership and involvement by members in IDEA itself, and that it developed a credible voice. So it's interesting, I think, that an awful lot of those have actually been successfully addressed over the years. So basically then, there was the strategic planning process, that was completed at the end of 2005, and it was the National Council then in 2006. And I found this work plan for 2006 in my files, which is really interesting, because they were clearly really, really active. And they just set about trying to establish that, and particularly to try and get the funding for the organisation so they could do all the rest. So and then they got funding from RHA, just for 1 year funding to appoint a director. There were clearly working groups that I'd forgotten about, really. It was a regional working group, can you believe it, of DECNET. Who can remember DECNET? DECNET was the network of the development education, sorry, the One World Centres all around the country, which was very active for a long time. Susan will remember that very well. And so basically then their top priority was the establishment of a visible base for the organisation, as I said. That so they set about getting the funding from RHA for at least 1 year funding for a director, so that actually could happen. It's interesting, the second priority was improving communication across the sector. So that's when setting up the working groups and setting up particularly the regional working group. Priority number three was exchanging experience and analysis across the sector, which is kind of similar to number two. So again, that was really the working groups. And promoting good practice, they hadn't done an awful lot of that in 2006, but it was there as one of the strategic priorities. So then they got the money and they advertised for a director. This is the end of October 2006. So I saw this advert, and I just had such a good experience with, and I just loved what I saw out there in terms of the energy and the vibrancy and the activism of the sector. So I went and applied for the job, and actually got the job. So I was delighted. So I then worked for 2 years, really, 2007 and 2008, for the sector, until really we got 3 year funding, until we got much more long term funding. And I worked part time, which I wanted to do, and that gave the opportunity to look for a full time person and look for a different kind of future, if you like, a building of the future. So primarily, I suppose what I set out to do, there were clearly all these wonderful people and these active people. There was no organisation whatsoever, and a lot of the work that I do in both the community sector and in the development education sector is organisation development. So, and I'd run organisations before, I'd been a director of other organisations. So, but I had community, my values were completely around community work and collective and ownership by the members. And I really was conscious that I didn't want IDEA to get to be an organisation that was only the director, you know, that you wanted it to be. Owned by the members, or it wouldn't work. So then I suppose what I set about was doing all the big structures, you know, getting a constitution, getting a memorandum and articles, getting a register for a charity, all those kind of very basic sort of things, but also getting really, really working with the National Council to make sure that they were really all engaged. And I remember Patsy Toller was the chairperson at the time, was a great, great chairperson. And I remember he said to me right at the beginning, oh, he said, it's great. It's great now. We can all stand back and do nothing. And I said, I don't think so, Patsy. So basically, we set up more working groups. So there were a membership working group. The regional working group carried on for a while. I don't quite know what happened. to that, actually. It was a good practice working group. And then a whole pile of task groups, really, which worked on just the conferences. We did two big conferences, one in 2007, one 2008, and 2008. We had, it was the first really proper annual, 2007 rather, was the first annual AGM, proper AGM. There were annual meetings before, general meetings, but in terms of formal sense, the first AGM. And the first of the two conferences. And it's very interesting looking at the first of the two conferences. There were two big conferences. And I still got the reports from both of them. And one of the first one was actually around minority ethnic communities, opportunity and child minority ethnic communities and development education in Ireland. And that was one of the priorities at the time because we felt we were a very homogenous sector. And it's really interesting reading this report again, some of the recommendations, because it's one of the areas where I don't think we've done very well. Across the board, not very well elsewhere. And the second was that was a linking and immersion scheme in the Global South, developing good practice. And that actually formed the basis of a lot of the thinking around worldwide global schools. So there's a lot of connectivity there. And that was again, a really good conference. And the report, a lot of thinking from what I gathered from the people who then ran Worldwise Global Schools, it acted as a really good just framework, especially in the early days. Yeah, this was just a little leaflet of one of the workshops, and I had completely forgotten this workshop. I remember the one we ran on media in those 2 years, and then this other workshop in Theatre of the Oppressed. We ran it in Derry. Those were kind of about, some of them were about skill sharing, skill development, like the media workshop. That was really about how we develop our skills. But this is more about how we developed our, but it was also something about really having a lot of fun and actually building some of our creativity. The working groups, we did a lot of mentoring. I remember we set up just in terms of that whole inclusivity and membership led, we set up a really nice structured mentoring scheme with the new people coming on the National Council and really making sure for a full 6 months that they were really engaged with somebody else who'd been there for a long period of time. For the first 6 or 8 months, it was in my little office here in Bibsborough. And then we found this place in Merrion Row. We remember Merrion Row. It was Dickensian, is all I can describe it as. It had rickety stairs.
I agree.
It was a fire hazard. It was, when we found this room, an amazing room, but it was like it had 100 years of dirt on the wall. Dirt on the walls. So we slapped a coat of paint all over the whole of it. And it was an amazing place then to have an office right in the middle of town. And it kind of really, I suppose, finished that whole formalization of the structures of IDEA and brought us into line with what we developed to be, I think. Yeah. So for me, very good experience. I moved on at the end of 2008 when we got the 3-year funding, which was great. So that was a lot of my time looking for the funding, getting the proper 3-year multi-annual funding. And then the great Matthias Fiddler took over and did a great few years with IDEA. So I think that's, I mean, anything anybody wants to ask.
That's great.
Great fun finding all those old files. So.
No, it's great.
You're like it was memory lane.
You have the IDEA archive, definitely. So
I have the archives. How much are they worth? Not a lot, but you can have them back.
So yeah, we'll definitely arrange for that. But thank you so much for your personal reflections and insights and sharing so much about those early years, even before IDEA was established.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to check out our website for more. Until the next time.